Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting. It's the Sleep Number Everything Smart Bed Sale. Every smart bed and base are on sale during our Memorial Day event. Up to 50% off, plus free home delivery. Limited time. Exclusively the Sleep Number store near you. Learn more at sleepnumber.com.
Part the First, Chapter 8 of Dick Sands, The Boy Captain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alex E. Talander, Davis, California. Dick Sands, The Boy Captain, by Jules Verne. Translated by Ellen E. Frewer. Part the First, Chapter 8, A Catastrophe. Experienced whaleman as he was, Captain Hull knew the difficulty of the task he had undertaken. He was alive to the importance of making his approach to the whale from the leeward, so that there should be no sound to apprise the creature of the proximity of the boat. He had perfect confidence in his boatswain, and felt sure that he would take the proper course to ensure a favorable result to the enterprise. "We mustn't show ourselves too soon, Howick," he said. "Certainly not," replied Howick. "I am going to skirt the edge of the discolored water, and I shall take good care to be at well to leeward." "All right," the captain answered, and turning to the crew, said, "Now, my lads, as quietly as you can," muffling the sound of their oars by placing straw in the rowlocks, and avoiding the least unnecessary noise, the men skillfully propelled the boat along the outline of the water, tinged by the crustacea, so that while the starboard oars still dipped in the green and limpid sea, the larboard were in the deep-dyed waves, and seemed as they were dripping with blood. "Wine on this side, water on that," said one of the sailors jocosely. "But neither of them fit to drink," rejoined the captain shortly, "so just hold your tongue." Under Howick's guidance, the boat now glided stealthily onto the greasy surface of the reddened waters, where she appeared to float as on a pool of oil. The whale seemed utterly unconscious of the attack that was threatening it, and allowed the boat to come nearer without exhibiting any sign of alarm. The wide circuit which the captain had thought it advisable to take had the effect of considerably increasing the distance between his boat and the Pilgrim, whilst the strange rapidity with which objects at sea become diminished in apparent magnitude, as if viewed through the wrong end of a telescope, made the ship look farther away than she actually was. Another half-hour elapsed, and at the end of it the captain found himself so exactly to leeward that the huge body of the whale was precisely intermediate between his boat and the Pilgrim. A closer approach must now be made, every precaution must be used, but the time had come to get sufficiently near for the harpoon to be discharged. "Slowly, my men," said the captain, in a low voice. "Slowly and softly." Howick muttered something that implied that the whale had ceased blowing so hard, and that it was aware of their approach. The captain upon this enjoined the most perfect silence, but urged his crew onwards, until, in 5 or 6 minutes, they were within a cable's length of the finback. Erect at the stern, the boatswain stood and manoeuvred to get the boat as close as possible to the whale's left flank, while he made it an object of special care to keep beyond the reach of its formidable tail, one stroke of which could involve them all in instantaneous disaster. The manipulation of the boat thus left to the boatswain, the captain made ready for the arduous effort that was before him. At the extreme bow, harpoon in hand, with his legs somewhat astride so as to ensure his equilibrium, he stood prepared to plunge his weapon into the mass that rose above the surface of the sea. By his side, coiled in a pail, and with one end firmly attached to the harpoon, was the first of the 5 lines which, if the whale should dive to a considerable depth, would have to be joined end to end, one after another. "Are you ready, my lads?" said he, hardly above a whisper. "Aye, aye, sir," replied Howick, speaking as gently as his master, and giving a firmer grip to the rudder oar that he held in his hands. "Then alongside, at once," was the captain's order, which was promptly obeyed, so that in a few minutes the boat was only about 10 feet from the body of the whale. The animal did not move. Was it asleep? In that case there was hope that the very first stroke might be fatal. But it was hardly likely. Captain Hull felt only too sure that there was some different cause to be assigned for its remaining so still and stationary, and the rapid glances of the boatswain showed that he entertained the same suspicion. But it was no time for speculation. The moment for action had arrived, and no attempt was made on either hand to exchange ideas upon the subject. Captain Hull seized his weapon tightly by the shaft, and having poised it several times in the air, in order to make sure more sure of his aim, he gathered all his strength and hurled it against the side of the finback. "Back water!" he shouted. The sailors pushed back with all their might, and the boat in an instant was beyond the range of the creature's tail. And now the immovableness of the animal was at once accounted for. "See, there's a youngster!" exclaimed Howick. And he was not mistaken. Startled by the blow of the harpoon, the monster had heeled over onto its side, and the movement revealed a young whale which the mother had been disturbed in the act of suckling. It was a discovery which made Captain Hull aware that the capture of the whale would be attended with double difficulty. He knew that she would defend her little one, if such a term can be applied to a creature that was at least 20 feet long, with the most determined fury. Yet having made what he considered a successful commencement of the attack, he would not be daunted, nor deterred from his endeavour to secure so fine a prize. The whale did not, as sometimes happens, make a precipitate dash upon the boat, a proceeding which necessitates the instant cutting of the harpoon line and an immediate retreat, but it took the far more usual course of diving downwards almost perpendicularly. It was followed by its calf. Very soon, however, after rising once again to the surface with a sudden bound, it began swimming along under water with great rapidity. Before its first plunge, Captain Hull and Howick had sufficient opportunity to observe that it was an unusually large Balaenoptera, measuring at least 80 feet from head to tail, its colour being of a yellowish brown, dappled with numerous spots of a darker shade. The pursuit, or what may be more aptly termed the towing, of the whale had now fairly commenced. The sailors had shipped their oars, and the whaleboat darted like an arrow along the surface of the waves. In spite of the oscillation, which was very violent, Howick succeeded in maintaining equilibrium, and did not need the repeated injunctions with which the agitated captain urged his boatswain to be upon his guard. But fast as the boat flew along, she could not keep pace with the whale, and so rapidly did the line run out that except proper care had been taken to keep the bucket in, which it was coiled filled with water, the friction against the edge of the boat would inevitably have caused it to take fire. The whale gave no indication of moderating its speed, so that the first line was soon exhausted, and the second had to be attached to its end, only to be run out with like rapidity. In a few minutes more it was necessary to join on the third line. It was evident that the whale had not been hit in a vital part, and so far from rising to the surface, the oblique direction of the rope indicated that the creature was seeking yet greater depths. "Confound it!" exclaimed the captain. "It seems as if the brute is going to run out all our line." "Yes, and see what a distance the animal is dragging us away from the Pilgrim," answered Howick. "Sooner or later, however," said Captain Hull, "the thing must come to the surface. She is not a fish, you know." "She is saving her breath for the sake of her speed," said one of the sailors with a grin. But grin as he might, both he and his companions began to look serious when the fourth line had to be added to the third, and more serious still when the fifth was added to the fourth. The captain even began to mutter imprecations upon the refractory brute that was putting their patience to a so severe a test. The last line was nearly all uncoiled, and the general consternation was growing very great, when there was observed to be a slight slackening in the tension. "Thank heaven!" cried the captain. "The beast has hired herself out, at last." Casting his eye towards the Pilgrim, he saw at a glance that she could not be less than 5 miles to leeward. It was a long distance, but when, according to his arrangement, he had hoisted the flag on the boat-hook, which was what to be the signal for the ship to approach, he had the satisfaction of seeing that Dick Sands and the negro at once began bracing the yards to get as near as possible to the wind. The breeze, however, blew only in short, unsteady puffs, and it was only too evident that the Pilgrim would have considerable difficulty in working her way to the whale ship, even if she succeeded at last. Meantime, just as had been expected, the whale had risen to the surface of the water, the harpoon still fixed firmly in her side. She remained motionless, apparently waiting for her craft, which she had far outdistanced in her mad career. Captain Hull ordered his men to pull towards her as rapidly as they could, and on getting up close up, two of the sailors, following the captain's example, shipped their oars and took up the long lances with which the whale was now to be attacked. Howick held himself in readiness to sheer off quickly in the event of the finback making a turn towards the boat. "Now, my lads," shouted the captain, "look out, take a good aim, no false shots. Are you ready, Howick?" "Quite ready, captain," answered the boatswain, adding, "but it perplexes me altogether to see the brute so quiet all of a sudden." "It looks suspicious," said the captain. "But never mind, go on, straight ahead." Captain Hull was becoming more excited every moment. During the time the boat was approaching, the whale had only turned round a little in the water, without changing its position. It was evidently still looking for its calf, which was not to be seen by its side. All of a sudden it gave a jerk with its tail, which it carried some few yards away. The men were all excited. Was the beast going to escape again? Was the fatiguing pursuit all to come over a second time? Must not the chase be abandoned? Would not the prize have to be given up? But no, the whale was not starting on another fight. It had merely turned so as to face the boat, and now, rapidly beating the water with its enormous fins, it commenced a frantic dash forwards. "Look out, Howick! She's coming!" shouted Captain Hull. The skillful boatswain was all on the alert. The boat swerved as if by instinct, so as to avoid the blow, and as the whale passed furiously by, she received 3 tremendous thrusts from the lances of the captain and the 2 men, who all endeavoured to strike at some vital part. There was a sudden pause. The whale spouted up two gigantic columns of blood and water, lashed his tail, and with bounds and plunges that were terrible to behold, renewed its angry attack upon the boat. None but the most determined of whalemen could fail to lose their head under such an assault. Calm and collected, however, the crew remained. Once again did Howick adroitly sheer aside, and once again did the three lances do their deadly work upon the huge carcass as it rolled impetuously past. But this time, so great was the wave that was caused by the infuriated animal, that the boat was well nigh full of water, and in imminent danger of being capsized. "Bail away, men!" cried the captain. Putting down their oars, the other sailors set to work, bailing with all their might. Captain Hull cut the harpoon line, now no longer required, because the whale, maddened with pain and grief for the loss of its offspring, would certainly make no further attempt to escape, but to fight desperately to the very end. The finback was obviously bent on a third onslaught upon the boat, which, being in spite of all the men's exertions still more than half full of water, no longer answered readily to the rudder oar. No one thought of flight. The swiftest boat could be overtaken in a very few bounds. There was no alternative but to face the encounter. It was not long in coming. Their previous good fortune failed them. The whale in passing caught the boat with such a violent blow from its dorsal fin that the men lost their footing and the lances missed their mark. "Where's Howick?" screamed the captain in alarm. "Here I am, captain. All right," replied the boatswain, who had scrambled to his feet only to find that the oar with which he had been steering was snapped in half. "The rudder's smashed," he said. "Take another. Howick, quick!" cried the captain. But scarcely had he time to replace the broken oar, when a bubbling was heard a few yards away from the boat, and the young whale made its appearance on the surface of the sea. Catching sight of it instantly, the mother made a fresh dash in its direction. The maternal instincts were aroused, and the contest must become more deadly than ever. Captain Hull looked towards the pilgrim, and waved his signal frantically above his head. It was, however, with no hope of succour. He was only too well aware that no human effort could effectually hasten the arrival of the ship. Dick Sands, indeed, had at once obeyed the first summons. Already the wind was filling the sails, but in default of steam power, her progress at best could not be otherwise than slow. Not only did Dick feel convinced that it would be a useless waste of time to lower a boat and come off with the negroes to the rescue, but he remembered the strict orders he had received on no account to quit the ship. Captain Hull, however, could perceive that the apprentice had had the aft boat lowered, and was towing it along, so that it should be in readiness for a refuge as soon as they should get within reach. But the whale, close at hand, demanded attention that could ill be spared for the yet distant ship. Covering her young one with her body, she was manifestly designing another charge full upon the boat. "On your guard, Howick! Sheer off!" bellowed the captain. But the order was useless. The fresh oar that the boatswain had taken to replace the broken one was considerably shorter, and consequently it failed in lever power. There was, in fact, no helm for the boat to answer. The sailors saw the failure, and convinced that all was lost, uttered one long, despairing cry that might have been heard on board the Pilgrim. Another moment, and from beneath there came a tremendous blow from the monster's tail that sent the boat flying in the air. In fragments it fell back again into a sea that was lashed into fury by the angry flapping of the finback's fins. Was it not possible for the unfortunate men, bleeding and wounded as they were, still to save themselves by clinging to some floating spar? Captain Hull is indeed seen endeavouring to hoist the boatswain on to a drifting plank, but all in vain. There is no hope. The whale, writhing in the convulsions of death, returns yet once again to the attack. The waters around the struggling sailors seethe and foam. A brief turmoil follows as if there were the bursting of some vast waterspout. In a quarter of an hour afterwards, Dick Sands, with the negroes, reaches the scene of the catastrophe. All is still and desolate. Every living object has vanished. Nothing is visible except a few fragments of a whaleboat floating on the blood-stained water. End of Part the First, Chapter 8. Recording by Alex Hetelander, Davis, California. www.alexhetelander.com. Part the First, Chapter 9 of Dick Sands, the Boy Captain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alex Hetelander, Davis, California. Dick Sands, the Boy Captain, by Jules Verne, translated by Ellen E. Frewer. Part the First, Chapter 9, Dick's Promotion. The first feeling experienced by those on board the Pilgrim after witnessing the terrible disaster was one of grief and horror at the fearful death that had befallen the victims. Captain Hull and his men had been swept away before their very eyes, and they had been powerless to assist. Not one was saved. The schooner had reached the spot too late to offer the least resistance to the attacks of the formidable sea monster. When Dick and the negroes returned to the ship after their hopeless search, with only the corroboration of their sad foreboding that captain and crew had disappeared forever, Mrs. Weldon sank upon her knees. Little Jack knelt beside her, crying bitterly, and Dick, old Nan, and all the negroes stood reverently around her, whilst with great devoutness the lady offered up the prayer of commendation for the souls of the departing. All sympathized heartily with her supplications, nor was there any diminution of their fervor when she proceeded to implore that the survivors might have strength and courage for their own hour of need. The situation was indeed very grave. Here was the Pilgrim in the middle of the Pacific, hundreds of miles away from the nearest land, without captain, without crew, at the mercy of the wind and waves. It was a strange fatality that had brought the whale across their path. It was a fatality stranger still that had induced her captain, a man of no ordinary prudence, to risk even his life for the sake of making good a deficient cargo. It was an event almost unknown in the annals of whale fishing, that not a single man in the whale boat should escape alive. Nevertheless, it was all too true, and now, of all those left on board, Dick Sands, the apprentice boy of 15 years of age, was the sole individual who had the slightest knowledge of the management of a ship. The negroes, brave and willing as they were perfectly ignorant of seamen's duties, and to crown all, here was a lady with her child on board, for whose safety the commander of the vessel would be held responsible. Such were the facts which presented themselves to the mind of Dick, as, with folded arms, he stood gazing gloomily at the spot where Captain Hull, his esteemed benefactor, had sunk to rise no more. The lad raised his eyes sadly. He scanned the horizon with a vain hope that he might perchance descry some passing vessel to which he could confide Mrs. Weldon and her son. For himself, his mind was made up. He had already resolved that nothing should induce him to quit the Pilgrim until he had exhausted every energy in trying to carry her into port. The ocean was all deserted. Since the disappearance of the whale, nothing had broken the monotonous surface, either of sea or sky. The apprentice, short as his experience was, knew enough to be aware that he was far out of the common track, alike of merchantmen or whalers. He would not buoy himself up with false expectations. He would look his situation full and fairly in the face. He would do his best, and trust hopefully in guidance from the power above. Thus absorbed in his meditations, he did not observe that he was not alone. Negoro, who had gone below immediately after the catastrophe, had again come back upon deck. What this mysterious character had felt upon witnessing the awful calamity, it would be impossible to say, although with his eye he had keenly taken in every detail of the melancholy spectacle, every muscle of. His face had remained unmoved, not a gesture, not a word betrayed the least emotion. Even if he had heard, he had taken no part, nor evinced the faintest interest in Mrs. Weldon's outpouring of prayer. He had made his way to the stern, where Dick Sands was pondering over the responsibilities of his own position, and stood looking towards the apprentice, without interrupting his reverie. Catching sight of him, Dick roused himself in an instant, and said, "You want to speak to me?" "I may speak either to the captain or the boatswain," answered the man. "Negoro," said Dick sharply, "you know as well as I do that they are both drowned." "Then where am I to get my orders from?" asked the fellow insolently. "From me," promptly rejoined the apprentice. "From you? From a boy of 15? "Yes, from me," repeated Dick, in a firm and resolute voice, looking at the man until he recoiled under his gaze. "From me." Mrs. Weldon had heard what passed. "I wish every one on board to understand," she interposed, "that Dick Sands is captain now. Orders must be taken from him, and they must be obeyed." Negoro frowned, bit his lips, sneered, and having muttered something that was unintelligible, made his way back to his cabin. Meantime, the schooner, under the freshening breeze, had been carried beyond the shoal of the crustaceans. Dick cast his eye first at the sails, then along the deck, and seemed to become more and more alive to the weight of the obligation that had fallen upon him. But his heart did not fail him. He was conscious that the hopes of the passengers centered in himself, and he was determined to let them see that he would do his best not to disappoint them. Although he was satisfied of his capability, with the help of the negroes, to manipulate the sails, he was conscious of a defect of the scientific knowledge which was requisite for properly controlling the ship's course. He felt the want of a few more years' experience. If only he had had longer practice, he would, he thought, have been as able as Captain Hull himself, to use the sextant, to take the altitude of the stars, to read the time from his chronometer. Sun, moon, and planets should have been his guides. From the firmament, as from a dial-plate, he would have gathered the teachings of his true position. But all this was beyond him as yet. His knowledge went no further than the use of the log and compass, and by these alone he must be content to make his reckonings. But he kept up his courage, and did not permit himself to, for one moment, to despair of ultimate success. Mrs. Weldon needed little penetration to recognize the thoughts which were passing in the mind of the resolute youth. "I see you have come to your decision, Dick," she said. "The command of the ship is in your hands. No fear but that you will do your duty. And Tom, and the rest of them, no doubt, will render you every assistance in their power." "Yes, Mrs. Weldon," rejoined Dick brightly, "and before long I shall hope to make them good seamen. If only the weather lasts fair, everything will go on well enough. And if the weather turns out bad, we must not despond. We will get safe ashore." He paused a moment, and added reverently, "God helping us." Mrs. Weldon proceeded to inquire whether he had any means of ascertaining the Pilgrim's present position. He replied that the ship's chart would at once settle that. Captain Hull had kept the reckoning accurately right up to the preceding day. "And what do you propose to do next?" she asked. "Of course, you understand that in our present circumstances, we are not in the least bound to go to Valparaiso if there is a nearer port which we could reach." "Certainly not," replied Dick, "and therefore it is my intention to sail due east, as by following that course, we are sure to come upon some part of the American coast. Do your best, Dick, to let us get ashore somewhere." "Never fear, madam," he answered. "As we get nearer land, we shall be almost sure to fall in with a cruiser, which will put us into the right track. If the wind does but remain in the northwest, and allow us to carry plenty of sail, we shall get on famously." He spoke with the cheery confidence of a good sailor who knows the good ship beneath his feet. He had moved off a few steps to go and take the helm, when Mrs. Weldon, calling him back, reminded him that he had not yet ascertained the true position of the schooner. Dick confessed that it ought to be done at once, and going to the captain's cabin, brought out the chart upon which the ill-fated commander had marked the bearings that evening before. According to this dead reckoning, they were in latitude 43° 35' south, and longitude 164° 13' west, and as the schooner had made next to no progress during the last 24 eventful hours, the entry might fairly be accepted as representing approximately their present position. To the lady's inexperienced eye, as she bent over the outspread chart, it seemed that the land, as represented by the brown patch which depicted the continent of South America, extended like a barrier between two oceans from Cape Horn to Columbia, was, after all, not so very far distant. The wide space of the Pacific was not so broad but that it would be quickly traversed. "Oh, we shall soon be on shore," she said. But Dick knew better. He had acquaintance enough with the scale upon which the chart was constructed to be aware that the Pilgrim herself would have been a speck like a microscopic infusoria on the vast surface of that sea, and that hundreds and hundreds of weary miles separated her from the coast. No time was to be lost. Contrary winds had ceased to blow, a fresh northwesterly breeze had sprung up, and the cirri, or curl cloud, overhead indicated that for some time at least the direction of the wind would be unchanged. Dick appealed to the negroes, and tried to make them appreciate the difficulty of the task that had fallen to his lot. Tom answered, in behalf of himself and all the rest, that they were not only willing, but anxious, to do all they could to assist him, saying that if their knowledge was small, yet their arms were strong, and added that they should certainly be obedient to every order he gave. "My friends," said Dick, addressing them in reply, "I shall make it a point of myself, taking the helm as much as possible, but you know I must have my proper rest sometimes. No one can live without sleep. Now, Tom, I intend you to stand by me for the remainder of the day. I will try and make you understand how to steer by aid of the compass. It is not difficult. You will soon learn. I shall have to leave you when I go to my hammock for an hour or two."
"Is there nothing," said little Jack, "that I can learn to do?"
"Oh, yes, Jack, you shall keep the wind in order," answered Dick, smiling.
"That I will," cried the child, clapping his hands, while the mother drew him to her side.
"And now, my men," was Dick's first order to his crew, "we must brace in the yards to sail fair. I will show you how." "All right, Captain Sands, we are at your service," said Tom gravely.
End of part the first, chapter 9. Recording by Alex C. Talander, Davis, California. www.alexctalander.com.
Part the first, chapter 10 of Dick Sands, the Boy Captain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alex C. Talander, Davis, California. Dick Sands, the Boy Captain, by Jules Verne, translated by Ellen E. Frewer. Part the First, Chapter 10, The New Crew. Dick Sands, captain of the Pilgrim, would not lose a moment in getting his ship under sail. His prime object was to land his passenger safely at Valparaiso, or some other American port, and to accomplish his purpose it was in the first place necessary that he should ascertain the schooner's rate of speed and the direction that she was taking. This information was to be obtained, readily enough, by means of the log and compass, and the result of each day's observations would be entered regularly on the chart. The log on board was a patent log, with a dial plate and screw, by means of which the distance that is travelled could be measured accurately for any infinite time. It was an instrument so simple that the negroes were very soon taught its use. The slight error in the reckoning caused by the action of the currents could only be rectified by astronomical observations, which, as already had been stated, were beyond Dick's attainments to make. The idea more than once crossed Dick's mind whether he would not take the Pilgrim back again to New Zealand. The distance was considerably less than it was to America, and had the wind remained in the quarter whence it had been blowing so long, it is more than likely he would have determined to retrace his course. But as the wind had now veered to the northwest, and there was every probability that it was settled for a time, he came to the conclusion that he had better take advantage of it and persevere in making his way towards the east. Accordingly, he lost no time in putting his ship before the wind. On a schooner, the foremast usually carries four square sails, on the lower mast a foresail, and on the top mast a topsail. On the top gallant, a top gallant sail and a royal. The mainmast carries only a mainsail and a topsail. Between the masts upon the forestays can be hoisted a triple tier or of triangular sails, while the bowsprit with its jib boom will carry the three jibs. The jibs, the mainsail, the main topsail, and the staysails are all managed with comparative ease, because they can be hoisted from the deck without the necessity of ascending the mast to let fly the robins, by which they are fastened to the yards. With the sails on the foremast, it is altogether a more difficult business. In order either to unfurl them, to take them in, or to reef them, it is necessary for a man to clamber up by the shrouds, either to the foretop or to the top-gallant cross-trees, and thence mounting by loose ropes extended below the yards to hold on by one hand whilst he does his work with the other. The operation requires alike the head and arm of an experienced mariner, and when a fresh breeze has been blowing, it is a casualty far before more common that a sailor, confused by the flapping of the canvas and the pitching of the vessel, should be blown overboard in the act. For the unpracticed negroes, the danger would necessarily be very great. However, the wind at present was very moderate, and the ship ploughed her way over the waves without any violent oscillations.
At the time when Dick Sands, in obedience to the signal he received from Captain Hull, proceeded to make his way to the scene of the disaster, the Pilgrim, as she lay to, was carrying only her jibs, mainsail, foresail, and foretopsail. In order, therefore, to put her as near as possible to the wind, it had been nearly necessary to counterbrace the foresail yard, a manoeuvre in which the negroes had rendered all the assistance that was necessary. It was requisite now to do something more. To enable him to get straight before the wind, Dick wanted to increase his sail, and was desirous of hoisting the topgallant, the royal, the main topsail, and the staysails. He was himself standing at the wheel. "Now, my men," he shouted at the negroes, "I want your help. Do exactly as I tell you. Bear away, Tom." Tom looked puzzled. "Bear away. Unfasten that rope, I mean. And Bat, come along. Do the same as Tom." The men did what they were bidden. "That's right," continued Dick, and calling to Hercules said, "Now, Hercules, a good strong pull." To give such a direction to Hercules was somewhat imprudent. The rigging creaked again under his giant strength. "Gently, gently, my good fellow," said Dick, laughing. "You will have the mast down."
"I declare I hardly touch the rope," answered Hercules.
"Well, next time you must only pretend to touch it," said Dick, and continuing his order shouted, "Now slacken, let fly, make fast, now brace in the yards. All right, that's capital." The yards were loosened, the foresails turned slowly round, and catching the breeze gave a slight impetus to the ship. Dick's next orders were for the jib sheets to be set free, and then he called the men to the stern. "Now," said he, "we must look to the mainmast, but take care, Hercules, not to have it down." "I will be as careful as possible, Mr. Dick," submissively replied Hercules, as though he were afraid to commit himself to any rash promise. The manoeuvre was simple enough. The main sheet was gradually slackened. The great sail took the wind and added its powerful action to that of the foresails. The main topsail was next brought to bear. It was only clewed up, so that there was nothing to do except to pull the halyards, haul it aboard the tack, and unfurl it. But in pulling at the halyards, the muscular energy of Hercules, which was supplemented by that of Actaeon, not to forget little Jack, who had volunteered his assistance, proved to be overpowering, and the rope snapped in two. All three of them, of course, fell flat upon the deck, but fortunately neither of them was hurt, and Jack laughed heartily at his tumble as an excellent joke. "Up with you," cried Captain Dick. "There's no harm done. Splice the rope and haul away more gently next time." It took but a few minutes to execute the order, and the Pilgrim was soon sailing away rapidly with her head to the east. "Well done, my friend," said Dick, who had not left his post at the helm. "You will be first-rate sailors before the end of the voyage." "We shall do our best, I promise you, Captain Sands," replied Tom, making it a point to give the young commander his proper title. Mrs. Weldon also congratulated the new crew upon the success of their first attempt. "I believe it was Master Jack who broke that rope," said Hercules, with a slight twinkle in his eye. "He is very strong, I can tell you." Jack looked as though he thoroughly appreciated the compliment, and evidenced his satisfaction by giving his huge friend a hearty shake of the hand. There were still several sails that were not yet set. Running well before the wind as the Pilgrim was, Dick nevertheless felt that the gallant royal and staysails, if brought into service, would materially assist her progress, and he determined not to dispense with their help. The staysails could be hoisted from below, but to bring the gallant and royal into play demanded more experience than any of his crew had had. Knowing that he could not entrust the task to them, and yet resolved not to be balked of his wish to set them, he undertook the task himself. He first put Tom to the helm, showing him how to keep the schooner's head in the right direction, and having placed the other four, the royal and topgallant halyards, proceeded to mount the foremast. To clamber up the fore shrouds and the top shrouds under the cross trees was mere child's play to the active apprentice. In a few minutes he had unfurled the topgallant sail, mounted to the royal yard, unfurled the royal, again reached the cross trees, and having caught hold of one of the starboard backstays, had descended to the deck. There he gave the necessary directions, and the two sails were made fast, and both yards braced. Nor did this content him. The staysails were set between the masts, and thus the Pilgrim was running along, crowded to the full, with all her canvas. The only additional sails which Dick could possibly have employed would have been some studding sails to larboard, but as the setting of these was a matter of some difficulty, and they were not always readily struck in the case of a sudden squall, he contented himself without them. Again he took his place at the helm. The breeze was manifestly freshening, and the Pilgrim, almost imperceptibly heeling to starboard, glided rapidly along the surface of the water, leaving behind her a wake, smooth and clean, that bore plain witness to the true adjustment of her waterline. "This is good progress, Mrs. Weldon," he said. "May heaven grant the wind and weather may continue thus favorable." The lady in silence shook the boy's hand, and then, worn out with the excitement of the past hours, went to her cabin, where she lay down and fell into a troubled doze. The new crew remained on watch. They were stationed on the forecastle, in readiness to make any alteration which the sails might require. But the wind was so steady and unshifting that no need arose for their services. And Cousin Benedict? All this time where was he, and what had he been doing? He was sitting in his cabin. He had a magnifying glass in his hand, and was studying an articulata of the order Orthoptera, an insect of the Platidae family. Its characteristics are a roundish body, rather long wings, flat elytra, and a head hidden by the prothorax. He had been on deck at the time of the calamity. The ill-fated captain with the crew had been drowned before his very eyes, but he said nothing. Not that he was unmoved. To think that he was not struck with horror would be to libel his kind and pitying nature. His sympathy was aroused, especially for his cousin. He pressed her hand warmly as if he would assure her of his truest commiseration, but he said nothing. He hurried off towards his cabin, and who shall deny that it was to devise some wonderfully energetic measures that he would take in consequence of this melancholy event. Passing the kitchen, however, he caught sight of Negoro in the act of crushing a blatta, an American species of cockroach. He broke out in a storm of invective, and in tones of indignation demanded the surrender of the insect, which Negoro made with cool contempt. In a moment Captain Hull and his partners in death were all forgotten. The enthusiast had secured a prize with which he hastened to his own little compartment, where he was soon absorbed in proving to his own satisfaction, in opposition to the opinion of other entomologists, that the blattae of the Pharaspa species, which are remarkable for their colors, differ in their habits from blattae of the ordinary sort. For the remainder of the day, perfect order reigned on board the Pilgrim. Though they were unable to shake off the sickening feeling of horror roused by the frightful disaster, and felt that they had sustained a startling shock, all the passengers seemed mechanically to fall into their usual routine. Dick Sands, though avowedly at the wheel, seemed to be everywhere, with an eye for everything, and his amateur crew obeyed him readily, and with the promptness of a willing activity. Negoro made no further overt attempt to question the young captain's authority, but remained shut in his kitchen. Dick made no secret of his determination to place the cook in close confinement if he exhibited any future sign of insubordination. Hercules was ready to carry him off bodily to the hold, and old Nan was equally ready to take his place in the cooking department. Probably Negoro was aware of all this. At any rate, he did not seem disposed to give any further cause of offence at present. As the day advanced, the wind continued to freshen, but no shifting of the sails seemed necessary. The Pilgrim was running well. There was no need to diminish her spread of canvas. Masts as solid and as rigging as strong as hers could stand a far heavier breeze. As a general rule, it is deemed prudent in case of a squall to shorten sail at night, and especially to take in gallants and royal, but the weather prospects now were also promising and satisfactory. that Dick persuaded himself he was under no necessity to take this precaution, and he rather felt himself bound to take the strongest measures he could to expedite his reaching less unfrequented waters. He made up his mind, however, not to leave the deck at all that night. The young captain made every effort to get an approximate reckoning of the schooner's progress. He heaved the log every half hour and duly registered the result of each successive examination. There were two compasses on board, one in the binnacle, close under the eye of the helmsman, the other, an inverted compass, being attached to the rafters of the captain's cabin, so that without leaving his berth he could see whether the man in charge of the wheel was holding a proper course. Every vessel that is duly furnished for a lengthened voyage has always not only two compasses but two chronometers, one to correct the other. The Pilgrim was not deficient in this respect, and Dick Sands made a strong point of admonishing his crew that they should take special care of the compasses, which under their present circumstances were of such supreme importance. A misfortune, however, was in store for them. On the night of the 12th, while Dick was on watch, the compass in the cabin became detached from its fastening and fell on the floor. The accident was not discovered until the following morning. Whether the metal ferrule that had attached the instrument to the rafters had become rusty, or whether it had been worn away by additional friction, it seemed impossible to settle. All that could be said was that the compass was broken beyond repair. Dick was extremely grieved at the loss, but he did not consider that any one was to be blamed for the mishap, and could only resolve for the future to take extra care of the compass in the binnacle. With the exception of this contretemps, everything appeared to go on satisfactorily on board. Mrs. Weldon, reassured by Dick's confidence, had regained much of her wonted calmness, and was besides ever supported by the sincere religious spirit. She and Dick had many a long conversation together. The ingenuous lad was always ready to take the kind and intelligent lady into his counsel, and day by day would point out to her on the chart the registers he made as the result of his dead reckoning. He would then try and satisfy her that under the prevailing wind there could be no doubt they must arrive at the coast of South America. Moreover, he said that, unless he was much mistaken, they should sight the land at no great distance from Valparaiso. Mrs. Weldon had, in truth, no reason to question the correctness of Dick's representations. She showed that provided the wind remained in the same favorable quarter, there was every prospect of their reaching land in safety. Nevertheless, at times she could not resist the misgiving that would arise when she contemplated what might be the result of a change of wind or a breaking of the weather. With the light-heartedness that belonged to his age, Jack soon fell back into his accustomed pursuits, and was to be seen merrily running over the deck or romping with Dingo. At times, it is true, he missed the companionship of Dick, but his mother made him comprehend that now that Dick was captain, his time was too much occupied to allow him any leisure for play, and the child quite understood that he must not interrupt his old friend in his new duties. The negroes performed their work with intelligence, and seemed to make rapid progress in the art of seamanship. Tom had been unanimously appointed boatswain, and took one watch with Bat and Austin, the alternate watch being discharged by Dick himself with Hercules and Actaeon. One of them steered so that the other two were free to watch at the bows. As a general rule, Dick Sands managed to remain at the wheel all night. 5 or 6 hours sleep in the daytime sufficed for him, and during the time when he was lying down, he entrusted the wheel to Tom or Bat, who under his instructions had become very fair helmsmen. Although in these unfrequented waters there was little chance of running foul of any other vessel, Dick invariably took the precaution of lighting his signals, carrying a green light to starboard and a red light to port. His exertions, however, were a great strain upon him, and sometimes during the night his fatigue would induce a heavy drowsiness, and he steered, as it were, by instinct more than by attention. On the night of the 13th he was so utterly worn out that he was obliged to ask Tom to relieve him at the helm whilst he went down for a few hours' rest. Actaeon and Hercules remained on watch on the forecastle. The night was very dark, the sky was covered with heavy clouds that had formed in the chill evening air, and the sails on the topmast were lost in the obscurity. At the stern, the lamps on either side of the binnacle cast a faint reflection on the metal mountings of the wheel, leaving the deck generally in complete darkness. Towards 3 o'clock in the morning, Tom was getting so heavy with sleepiness that he was almost unconscious. His eye, long fixed steadily on the compass, lost its power of vision, and he fell into a doze from which it would require more than a slight disturbance to arouse him. Meantime, a light shadow glided stealthily along the deck. Creeping gradually up to the binnacle, Negoro put down something heavy that he had brought in his hand. He stole a keen and rapid glance at the dial of the compass, and made his way back, unseen and unheard, as he had come. Almost immediately afterwards, Tom awakened from his slumber. His eye fell instinctively on the compass, and he saw in a moment that the ship was out of her proper course. By a turn of the helm, he brought her head to what he supposed to be the east, but he was mistaken. During his brief interval of unconsciousness, a piece of iron had been deposited beneath the magnetic needle, which by this means had been diverted 30 degrees to the right, and instead of pointing due north, inclined far towards northeast. Consequently, it came to pass that the Pilgrim, supposed by her young commander to be making good headway due east, was in reality, under the brisk northwest breeze, speeding along towards the southeast. End of Part the First, Chapter 10. Recording by Alex C. Talander, Davis, California. www.alexctalander.com.
Part the First, Chapter 11 of Dick Sands, the Boy Captain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alex C. Talander, Davis, California. Dick Sands, the Boy Captain, by Jules Verne. Translated by Ellen E. Frewer. Part the First, Chapter 11, Rough Weather. During the ensuing week, nothing particular occurred on board. The breeze still freshened, and the Pilgrim made on the average 160 miles every 24 hours. The speed was as great as could be expected from a craft of her size. Dick grew more and more sanguine in his anticipations that it could not be long before the schooner would cross the track of the mail packets plying between the eastern and western hemispheres. He had made up his mind to hail the first passing vessel, and either to transfer his passengers, or what perhaps would be better still, to borrow a few sailors, and it might be an officer, to work the Pilgrim to shore. He could not help, however, a growing sense of astonishment, when day after day passed, and yet there was no ship to be signalled. He kept the most vigorous lookout, but all to no purpose. 3 voyages before had he mailed to the whale fisheries, and his experience made him sure that he ought now to be sighting some English or American vessel on its way between the equator and Cape Horn. Very different, however, was the true position of the Pilgrim from what Dick supposed. Not only had the ship been carried far out of her direct course by currents, the force of which there were no means of estimating, but from the moment when the compass had been tampered with by Negoro, the steering itself had put the vessel all astray. Unconscious of both of these elements of disturbance, Dick Sands was convinced that they were proceeding steadily eastwards, and was perpetually encouraging Mrs. Weldon and himself by the assurance that they would very soon arrive within view of the American coast, again and again asserting that his sole concern was for his passengers, and that for his own safety he had no anxiety. "But think, Dick," said the lady, "what a position you would have been in if you had not had your passengers. You would have been alone with that terrible Negoro. You would have been rather alarmed then." "I should have taken good care to put it out of Negoro's power to do me any mischief, and then I should have worked the ship by myself," answered the lad stoutly. His very pluck gave Mrs. Weldon renewed confidence. She was a woman with wonderful powers of endurance, and it was only when she thought of her little son that she had any feeling of despair. Yet even this she endeavoured to conceal, and Dick's undaunted courage helped her. Although the youth of the apprentice did not allow him to pretend to any advanced scientific knowledge, he had the proverbial weather-eye of the sailor. He was not only very keen in noticing any change in the aspect of the sky, but he had learned from Captain Hull, who was a clever meteorologist, to draw correct conclusions from the indications of the barometer. The captain, indeed, having taken the trouble to make him learn by heart the general rules which are laid down in Vorderpierre's Dictionnaire Illustré. There are 7 of these rules. 1. If after a long period of fine weather the barometer falls suddenly and continuously, although the mercury may be descending for 2 or 3 days before, there is an apparent change in the atmosphere, there will ultimately be rain, and the longer has been the time between the first depression and the commencement of the rain, the longer the rain may be expected to last. 2. Vice versa, if after a long period of wet weather the barometer begins to rise slow and steadily, fine weather will ensue, and the longer the time between the first rising of the mercury and the commencements of the fine weather, the longer the fine weather may be expected to last. 3. If immediately after the fall or rise of the mercury, a change of weather ensues, the change will be of no long continuance. Footnote. This and several of the other rules are concisely concentrated in the couplet, "Long foretold, long last, short notice, soon past." 4. A gradual rise for 2 or 3 days during which rain forecasts fine weather, but if there be a fall immediately on the arrival of the fine weather, it will not be for long. This rule holds also conversely. 5. In spring and autumn, a sudden fall indicates rain. In the summer, if very hot, it foretells a storm. In the winter, after a period of steady frost, a fall prognosticates a change of wind with rain and hail, whilst a rise announces the approach of snow. 6. Rapid oscillations of the mercury either way are not to be interpreted as indicating either wet or dry weather of any duration. Continuance of either fair or foul weather is forecast only by a prolonged and steady rise or fall beforehand. 7. At the end of autumn, after a period of wind and rain, a rise may be expected to be followed by north wind and frost.
Not merely had Dick got these rules by rote, but he had tested them by his own observations, and had become singularly trustworthy in his forecasts of the weather. He made a point of consulting the barometer several times every day, and although to all appearances the sky indicated that the fine weather was settled, it did not escape his observation that on the 20th the mercury showed a tendency to fall. Dick knew that rain, if it came, would be accompanied by wind, an opinion in which he was very soon confirmed by the breeze freshening, till the air was displaced at the rate of nearly 60 feet a second, or more than 40 miles an hour, and he recognized the necessity of at once shortening sail. He had already used the precaution to take in the royal, the main topsail, and the flying jib, but he now at once resolved likewise to take in the topgallant, and to have a couple of reefs in the fore topsail. To an inexperienced crew, the last operation was far from easy, but there was no symptom of shrinking from it. Followed by Bat and Austin, Dick mounted the rigging of the foremast, and with little trouble got to the topgallant. Had the weather been less unpromising, he would have been inclined to leave the 2 yards as they were, but anticipating the ultimate necessity of being obliged to lower the mast, he unrigged them, and let them bat down to the deck. He knew well enough that in the event of the gale, rising as he expected, the lowering the mast as well as the shortening of sail would contribute to diminish the strain and stress upon the vessel. It was the work of 2 hours to get this preliminary operation over. There still remained the task of taking in the reefs and the topsail. The Pilgrim in one respect differed from most modern vessels. She did not carry a double foretop, which would very much have diminished the difficulty attending the reefing. It was consequently necessary to proceed as before, to mount the rigging, by main force to haul in the flapping canvas, and to make the fastening secure. But critical and dangerous as the task was, it was successfully accomplished, and the 3 young men, having descended safely to the deck, had the satisfaction of seeing the schooner run easily before the wind, which had further increased till it was blowing a stiff gale. For 3 days the gale continued brisk and hard, yet without any variation in its direction. But all along the barometer was falling, the mercury sank to 28 degrees without symptom of recovery. The sky was becoming overcast, clouds thick and lowering obscured the sun, and it was difficult to make out where it rose or where it set. Dick did his best to keep up his courage, but he could not disguise from himself that there was cause for uneasiness. He took no more rest than was absolutely necessary, and what repose he allowed himself he always took on deck. He maintained a calm exterior, but he was really tortured with anxiety. Although the violence of the wind seemed to lull a while, Dick did not suffer himself to be betrayed in any false security. He knew only too well what to expect, and after a brief interval of comparative quiet, the gale returned, and the waves began to run very high. About 4 o'clock one afternoon, Negoro, a most unusual thing for him, emerged from his kitchen, and skulked to the fore. Dingo was fast asleep and did not make his ordinary growl, by way of greeting to his enemy. For half an hour Negoro stood motionless, apparently surveying the horizon. The heavy waves rolled past. They were higher than the condition of the wind warranted, their magnitude witness to a storm passing in the west, and there was every reason to suspect that the Pilgrim might be caught by its violence. Negoro looked long at the water. He then raised his eyes and scanned the sky. Above and below he might read threatening signs. The upper stratum of cloud was travelling far more rapidly than that beneath, in an indication that ere long the masses of vapour would descend, and coming in contact with the inferior current, would change the gale into a tempest, which probably would increase to a hurricane. It might be from ignorance, or it might be from indifference, but there was no indication of alarm on the face of Negoro. On the other hand, there might be seen a sort of smile curling on his lip. After thus gazing above him and around him, he clambered onto the bowsprit, and made his way by degrees to the very gammonings. Again he rested and looked about him as if to explore the horizon. After a while he clambered back on deck, and soon stealthily retreated to his own quarters. No doubt there was much to cause concern in the general aspect of the weather, but there was one point in which they never failed to congratulate each other, that the direction of the wind had never changed, and consequently must be carrying them in the desired course. Unless a storm should overtake them, they could continue their present navigation without peril, and with every prospect of finding a port upon the shore where they might put it. Such were their mutual and acknowledged hopes, but Dick secretly felt the misgiving lest, without a pilot, he might in his ignorance fail to find a harbour of refuge. Nevertheless, he would not suffer himself to meet trouble halfway, and kept up his spirits under the conviction that if difficulties came, he should be strengthened to grapple with them or make his escape. Time passed on, and the 9th of March arrived, without material change in the condition of the atmosphere. Sky remained heavily burdened, and the wind, which occasionally had abated for a few hours, had always returned with at least its former violence. The occasional rising of the mercury never encouraged Dick to anticipate a permanent improvement in the weather, and he discerned only too plainly that brighter times at present were not to be looked for. A startling alarm had more than once been caused by the sudden breaking of storms in which thunderbolts had seemed to fall within a few cables' lengths of the schooner. On these occasions the torrents of rain had been so heavy that the ship had appeared to be in the very midst of a whirlpool of vapour, and it was impossible to see a yard ahead. The Pilgrim pitched and rolled frightfully. Fortunately Mrs. Weldon could bear the motion without much personal inconvenience, and consequently was able to devote her attention to her little boy, who was a miserable sufferer. Cousin Benedict was as undisturbed as the cockroaches he was investigating. He hardly noticed the increasing madness of either wind or wave, but went on with his studies as calmly as if he were in his own comfortable museum at San Francisco. Moreover, it was fortunate that the negroes did not suffer to any great degree from seasickness, and consequently were able to assist their captain in his arduous task. Dick was far too experienced a sailor himself to be inconvenienced by any oscillations of the vessel, however violent. The Pilgrim still made good headway, and Dick, although he was aware that ultimately it would probably be necessary again to shorten sail, was anxious to postpone making any alteration before he was absolutely obliged. Surely, he reasoned with himself, the land could not now be far away. He had calculated his speed. He had kept a diligent reckoning on the chart. Surely the shore must be almost in sight. He would not trust his crew to keep watch. He was aware how easily their inexperienced eyes would be misled, and how they might mistake a distant cloud bank for the land they coveted to see. He kept watch for himself. His own gaze was ever fixed upon the horizon, and in the eagerness of his expectation he would repeatedly mount to the cross-trees to get a wider range of vision, but land was not to be seen. Next day, as Dick was standing at the bow, alternately considering the canvas which his ship carried and the aspect presented by the sky, Mrs. Weldon approached him without his noticing her. She caught some muttered expressions of bewilderment that fell from his lips, and asked him whether he could see anything. He lowered the telescope which he had been holding in his hand, and answered, "No, Mrs. Weldon, I cannot see anything, and as this Hyatt perplexes me so sorely, I cannot understand why we have not already come in sight of land. It is nearly a month since we lost our poor dear captain. There has been no delay in our progress, no stoppage in our rate of speed. I cannot make it out." "How far were we from land when we lost the captain?" "I am sure I am not far out in saying that we were scarcely more than 4,500 miles from the shores of America." "And at what rate have we been sailing?" "Not much less than 90 knots a day." "How long, then, do you reckon, Dick, we ought to be arriving at the coast?" "Under 26 days, replied Dick. He paused before he spoke again, then added, "But what mystifies me even more than our failing to sight the land is this. We have not come across a single vessel, and yet vessels without number are always traversing these seas." "But do you not think," inquired Mrs. Weldon, "that you have made some error in your reckoning? Is your speed really what you have supposed?" "Impossible, madam," replied Dick, with an air of dignity. "Impossible that I should have fallen into error. The log has been consulted, without fail, every half hour. I am about to have it lowered now, and I will undertake to show you that we are at this present moment making 10 miles an hour, which would give considerably over 200 miles a day." He then called out to Tom, "Tom, lower the log." The old man was quite accustomed to the duty. The log was fastened to the line and thrown overboard. It ran out regularly for about 25 fathoms, when all at once the line slackened in Tom's hand. "It is broken!" cried Tom. "The cord is broken!" "Broken?" exclaimed Dick. "Good heavens, we have lost the log!" It was too true. The log was gone. Tom drew in the rope. Dick took it up and examined. It had not broken at its point of union with the log. It had given way in the middle, at a place where the strands in some unaccountable way had worn strangely thin. Dick's agony of mind, in spite of his effort to be calm, was intensely great. A suspicion of foul play involuntarily occurred to him. He knew that the rope had been of first-rate make. He knew that it had been quite sound when used before, but he could prove nothing. He could only mourn over the loss which committed him to the sole remaining compass as his only guide. That compass, too, although he knew it not, was misleading him entirely. Mrs. Weldon sighed as she witnessed the grief which the loss manifestly caused poor Dick, but in pure sympathy she said nothing and retired thoughtfully to her cabin. It was no longer possible to reckon the rate of progress, but there was no doubt that the Pilgrim continued to maintain at least her previous speed. Before another 24 hours had passed, the barometer had fallen still lower, and the wind was threatening to rise to a velocity of 60 miles. Resolved to be on the safe side, Dick determined not only to strike the top-gallant and the main-top-mast, but to take in all the lower sails. Indeed, he began to be aware that no time was to be lost. The operation would not be done in a moment, and the storm was approaching. Dick made Tom take the helm. He ascended the shrouds with Bat, Austin, and Actaeon, making Hercules stay on deck to slacken the halyards as required. By dint of arduous exertion, and at no little risk of being thrown overboard by the rolling of the ship, they succeeded in lowering the two masts. The foretop sail was then reefed, and the foresail entirely struck, so that the only canvas that the schooner carried was the reefed foretop and the one stay. These, however, made her run with a terrific speed. Early on the morning of the 12th, Dick noted with alarm that the barometer had not ceased to fall, and now registered only 27.9 degrees. The tempest had continued to increase, till it was unsafe for the ship to carry any canvas at all. The order was given for the topsail to be taken in, but it was too late. A violent gust carried the sail completely away, and Austin, who had made his way to the foretop yard, was struck by the flying sheet, and although he was not seriously hurt, he was obliged at once to return to deck. Dick Sands became more uneasy than ever. He was tortured by apprehensions of reefs outlying the shore, to which he imagined he must now be close, but he could discern no rocks to justify his fears, and returned to take his place at the helm. The next moment Negoro appeared on deck. He pointed mysteriously to the far-off horizon, as though he discerned some object, as a mountain there, and looking round with a malevolent smile, immediately left the deck and went back to his cabin. End of Part the First, Chapter 11. Recording by Alex C. Talander, Davis, California, www.alexctalander.com. Part the First, Chapter 12 of Dick Sands, the Boy Captain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alex C. Talander, Davis, California. Dick Sands, the Boy Captain, by Jules Verne, translated by Ellen E. Frewer. Part the First, Chapter 12. Hope Revived. The wind had now increased to a hurricane. It had veered to the southwest and had attained a velocity little short of 90 miles an hour. On land, the most substantial of erections could without difficulty have withstood its violence, and a vessel anchored in a roadstead must have been torn from its moorings and cast ashore. The memorable storm that had devastated the island of Guadalupe on the 25th of July, 1825, when heavy cannon were lifted from the carriages, could scarcely have been more furious, and it was only her mobility before the blast and the solidity of her structure that gave the Pilgrim a hope of surviving the tempest. A few minutes after the topsail had been lost, the small jib was carried away. Dick Sands contemplated the possibility of throwing out a storm jib, made of extra strong canvas, as a means of bringing the ship a little more under his control, but abandoned the idea as useless. It was therefore under bare poles that the Pilgrim was driven along, but in spite of the lack of canvas, the hull, masts, and rigging gave sufficient purchase to the wind, and the progress of the schooner was prodigiously rapid. Sometimes, indeed, she seemed to be literally lifted from the water and scudded on, scarcely skimming its surface. The rolling was fearful. Enormous waves followed in quick succession as they travelled faster than the ship. There was the perpetual risk of one of them catching her astern. Without sail, there were no means of escaping that peril by increase of speed. The adroit management of the helm was the only chance of avoiding the hazardous shocks, and even this repeatedly failed. To prevent his being washed overboard, Dick lashed himself to his place at the wheel by a rope around his waist, and made Tom and Bat keep close at hand, ready to give him assistance in case of emergency. Hercules and Actaeon, clinging to the bit, kept watch of the bow. Mrs. Weldon and her party, at Dick's special request, remained inside the stern cabin, although the lady, for her own part, would much rather have stayed on deck. She had, however, yielded to the representation that she would thus be exposing herself to unnecessary danger. The hatchways were hermetically closed, and it was to be hoped that they would withstand the heavy sea that was dashing over them. Only let one of them give way to the pressure, and the vessel must inevitably fill and founder. It was a matter of congratulation that the stowage had been done very carefully, so that notwithstanding all the lurchings of the ship, the cargo did not shift in the least. The heroic young commander had still further curtailed his periods of rest, and it was only at the urgent entreaty of Mrs. Weldon, who feared that he would exhaust himself by his vigilance, that he was induced to lie down for a few hours' sleep on the night of the 13th. After Tom and Bat had been left alone at the wheel, they were, somewhat to their surprise, joined by Negoro, who very rarely came aft. He seemed inclined to enter into conversation, but found little encouragement to talk on their part either of Tom or his son. All at once a violent roll of the ship threw him off his feet, and he would have gone overboard if he had not been saved by falling against the binnacle. Old Tom was in a frantic state of alarm lest the compass should be broken. He uttered a cry of consternation so loud that it roused Dick from the slight slumber into which he had fallen in the cabin, and he rushed to the deck. Negoro had not only regained his feet, but had managed successfully to conceal the bit of iron which he had regained extracted from beneath the binnacle where he had himself laid out. Now that the wind had shifted to the southwest, it suited his machinations that the magnetic needle should indicate its true direction. "How now?" asked Dick eagerly. "What is the meaning of all this noise?"
Tom explained how the cook had fallen against the binnacle, and how he had been terrified lest the compass should be injured. Dick's heart sank at the thought of losing his sole remaining compass, and his anxiety betrayed itself in his countenance as he knelt down to examine its condition. But he breathed freely as he ascertained that the instrument had sustained no damage. By the dim light he saw the needle resting on its two concentric circles, and felt his fears at once relieved. Of course, he was quite unconscious of the fact that the removal of the bit of iron had made the magnet change its pointing. The incident, however, excited his misgiving. Although he felt that Negoro could not be held responsible for an accidental fall, the very presence of the man in such a place at such a time perplexed him. "And what brings you here, this hour of the night?" he asked.
"That's not your business," retorted Negoro insolently.
"It is my business," replied Dick resolutely, "and I mean to have an answer. What brought you here?"
Negoro answered sullenly that he knew of no rule to prevent his going where he liked and when he liked.
"No rule?" cried Dick. "Then I make the rule now. From this time forward, I make the rule that you shall never come astern. Do you understand?"
Roused from his accustomed doggedness, the man seemed to make a threatening movement. Quick as lightning, Dick Sands drew a revolver from his pocket.
"Negoro, one act, one word of insubordination, and I blow out your brains."
Negoro had no time to reply. Before he could speak, he was bowed down towards the deck by an irresistible weight. Hercules had grasped him by the shoulder.
"Shall I put him overboard, Captain? He will make a meal for the fishes. They are not very particular what they eat," said the negro, with a grin of content.
"Not yet," quietly answered Dick. The giant removed his hand, and Negoro stood upright again and began to retreat to his quarters, muttering, however, as he passed Hercules,
"You cursed nigger! You shall pay for this!"
The discovery was now made that the wind apparently had taken a sudden shift at no less than 45 degrees, but what occasioned Dick the greatest perplexity was that there was nothing in the condition of the sea to correspond with the alteration in the current of the air. Instead of being directly astern, wind and waves were now beating on the larboard. Progress in this way must necessarily be full of danger, and Dick was obliged to bring his ship up at least 4 points before he got astray before the tempest. The young captain felt that he must be more than ever on the alert. He could not shake off the suspicion that Negoro had been concerned in the loss of the first compass, and had some further designs upon the second. Still, he was utterly at a loss to imagine what possible motive the man could have for so criminal an act of malevolence, as there was no plausible reason to be assigned why he would not be as anxious as all the rest to reach the coast of America. The suspicion continued, however, to haunt him, and when he mentioned it to Mrs. Weldon, he found that a similar feeling of distrust had agitated her, although she, like himself, was altogether unable to allege a likely motive why the cook should contemplate so strange an act of mischief. It was determined that a strict surveillance should be kept upon all the fellow's movements. Negoro, however, manifested no inclination to disobey the captain's peremptory order. He kept strictly to his own part of the ship, but as Dingo was now regularly quartered on the stern, there was a tolerably sure guarantee that the cook would not be found wandering much in that direction. A week passed, and still the tempest showed no sign of abating. The barometer continued to fall, and not once did a period of calmer weather afford an opportunity of carrying sail. The Pilgrim still made her way northeast. Her speed could not be less than 200 miles in 24 hours, but no land appeared. Vast as was the range of the American continent, extending for 120 degrees between the Atlantic and the Pacific, it was nowhere to be discerned. Was he dreaming? Was he mad? Dick would perpetually ask himself. Had he been sailing in a wrong direction? Had he failed to steer aright? But no, he was convinced there was no error in his steering. Although he could not actually see it for the mist, he knew that day after day the sun rose before him and that it set behind him. Yet he was constrained in bewilderment to ask what had become of those shores of America upon which, when they came in sight, there was only too great a fear the ship would be dashed. What had become of them? Where were they? Whither had this incessant hurricane driven them? Why did not the expected coast appear? To all these bewildering inquiries, Dick could find no answer except to imagine that his compass had misled him. Yet he was powerless to put his own misgivings to the test. He deplored more than ever the destruction of the duplicate instrument which would have checked his registers. He studied his chart, but all in vain. The position in which he found himself as the result of Negoro's treachery seemed to baffle him the more he tried to solve the mystery. The days were passing on in this chronic state of anxiety, when one morning, about 8 o'clock, Hercules, who was on watch at the fore, suddenly shouted, "Land!" Dick Sands had little reliance upon the negro's inexperienced eye, but hurried forward to the bow. "Where's the land?" he cried, his voice being scarcely audible above the howling of the tempest. "There! Look there!" said Hercules, nodding his head and pointing over the larboard side to the northeast. Dick could see nothing. Mrs. Weldon had heard the shout. Unable to restrain her interest, she had left her cabin and was at Dick's side. He uttered an expression of surprise at seeing her, but could not hear anything she said, as her voice was unable to rise above the roaring of the elements. She stood, her whole being, as it were, concentrated in the power of vision, and scanned the horizon in the direction indicated by Hercules. But all to no purpose. Suddenly, however, after a while, Dick raised his hand. "Yes," he said. "Yes, sure enough, yonder is land." He clung with excitement to the netting, and Mrs. Weldon, supported by Hercules, strained her eyes yet more vehemently to get a glimpse of a shore which she had begun to despair of ever reaching. Beyond a doubt, an elevated peak was there. It must be about 10 miles to leeward. A break in the clouds soon left it more distinct. Some promontory it must be upon the American coast. Without sails, of course, the Pilgrim had no chance of bearing down direct upon it, but at least there was every reason to believe that she would soon reach some other portion of the shore. Perhaps before noon, certainly in a few hours, they must be close to land. The pitching of the ship made it impossible for Mrs. Weldon to keep safe footing on the deck. Accordingly, at a sign from Dick, Hercules led her back again to her cabin. Dick did not remain long at the bow, but went thoughtfully back to the wheel. He had indeed a tremendous responsibility before him. Here was the land for which they had longed so eagerly, and now that their anticipations were on the point of being realized, what was there, with the hurricane driving them on towards it, to prevent that land being their destruction? What measures could he take to prevent the schooner being dashed to pieces against it? At the very moment when the promontory was just abreast of them, Negoro appeared on deck. He nodded to the peak familiarly, as he might have saluted a familiar friend, and retired as stealthily as he had come. 2 hours later, and the promontory was lying to the larboard wake. Dick Sands had never relaxed his watchfulness, but he had failed to discover any further indications of a coastline. His perplexity could only increase. The horizon was clear. The Andes ought to be distinct. They would be conspicuous 20 miles or more away. Dick took up his telescope again and again. He scrutinized the eastern horizon with minutest care, but there was nothing to be seen, and as the afternoon waned away, the last glimpse had been taken of the promontory that had awakened their expectation. It had vanished utterly from their gaze. No indication of shore could be seen from the Pilgrim's deck. Dick Sands uttered a sigh of mingled amazement and relief. He went into Mrs. Weldon's cabin, where she was standing with her party. "It was only an island," he said. "Only an island." "How? Why? What island? What do you mean?" cried Mrs. Weldon incredulously. "What island can it be?" "The chart, perhaps, will tell us," replied Dick, and hurrying off to his own cabin, he immediately returned with the chart in his hands. After studying it attentively for a few minutes, he said, "There, Mrs. Weldon, the land we have just passed, I should suppose, must be that little speck in the midst of the Pacific. It must be Easter Island. At least, there seems to be no other land which possibly it could be." "And do you say," inquired Mrs. Weldon, "that we have left it quite behind us?" "Yes, entirely, almost to windward." Mrs. Weldon commenced a searching scrutiny of the map that was outspread before her. "How far is this?" she said, after bending a considerable time over the chart. "How far is this from the coast of America?" 35 degrees, answered Dick. "Somewhere about 2,500 miles. "Whatever do you mean?" rejoined the lady, astonished. "If the Pilgrim is still 2,500 miles from shore, she has positively made no progress at all. Impossible!" In thoughtful perplexity, Dick passed his hand across his brow. He did not know what to say. After an interval of silence, he said, "I have no account to give for the strange delay. It is inexplicable to myself, except upon that one hypothesis, which I cannot resist, that the readings of the compass somehow or other have been wrong." He relapsed into silence. Then, brightening up, he added, "But thank God, at least we have now the satisfaction of knowing where we really are. We are no longer lost upon the wide Pacific. If only this hurricane will cease, long as the distance seems, we are on our proper course to the shores of America." The tone of confidence with which the youthful captain spoke had the effect of inspiring new hope into all who heard him. Their spirits rose, and to their sanguine mood it seemed as if they were approaching to the end of all their troubles, and had hardly more to do than to await the turning of the tide to bring them into a glad proximity to port. Easter Island, of which the true name is Vaihu, was discovered by David in 1686, and visited by Cook and Leperouse. It lies in latitude 27 degrees south and longitude 112 degrees east. Consequently, it was evident that during the raging of the hurricane, the schooner had been driven northwards no less than 15 degrees. Far away, however, as she was from shore, the wind could hardly fail within 10 days to carry her within sight of land, and then, if the storm had worn itself out, as probably it would, the Pilgrim would again hoist sail and make her way into some port with safety. Anyhow, the discovery of his true position restored a spirit of confidence to Dick Sands, and he anticipated the time when he should no longer be drifting helplessly before the storm. To say the truth, the Pilgrim had suffered very little from the prolonged fury of the weather. The damage she had sustained was limited to the loss of the topsail and the small jib, which could be easily replaced. The caulking of the seams remained thoroughly sound, and no drop of water had found its way into the hold.
The pumps, too, were perfectly free. Dick Sands did not fear for the stability of his ship. His only anxiety was lest the weather should not moderate in time. Only let the wind subside, and the schooner once more would be under his control. But he never forgot that the ordering of the winds and waves were in the hands of the great disposer of all. End of Part the First, Chapter 12. Recording by Alex Hitalander, Davis, California. www.alexhitalander.com. Part the First, Chapter 13 of Dick Sands, the Boy Captain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alex Hitalander, Davis, California. Dick Sands, the Boy Captain, by Jules Verne, translated by Ellen E. Frewer. Part the First, Chapter 13. Land at Last. It was not long before Dick's sanguine expectations were partially realized, for on the very next day, which was the 27th, the barometer began to rise, not rapidly, but steadily, indicating that its elevation would probably continue. The sea remained exceedingly rough, but the violence of the winds, which had veered slightly towards the west, had perceptibly diminished. The tempest had passed its greatest fury and was beginning to wear itself out. Not a sail, however, could yet be hoisted. The smallest show of canvas would have been carried away in an instant. Nevertheless, Dick hoped that before another 24 hours were over, the Pilgrim might be able to carry a storm jib. In the course of the night, the wind moderated still more, and the pitching of the ship had so far diminished that the passengers began to reappear on deck. Mrs. Weldon was the first to leave her enforced imprisonment. She was anxious to speak to Dick, whom she might have expected to find looking pale and wan after his almost superhuman exertions and loss of sleep. But she was mistaken. However much the lad might suffer from the strain in after years, at present he exhibited no symptoms of failing energy. "Well, Captain Dick, how are you?" she said, as she advanced towards him holding out her hand. Dick smiled. "You call me Captain, Mrs. Weldon," he answered, "but you do not seem disposed to submit implicitly to the captain's orders. Did I not direct you to keep to your cabin?" "You did," replied the lady, "but observing how much the storm had abated, I could not resist the temptation to disobey you." "Yes, madam, the weather is far more promising. The barometer has not fallen since yesterday morning, and I really trust the worst is over now." "Thank heaven," she replied, and after a few moments' silence she added, "But now, Dick, you must really take some rest. You may perhaps not know how much it will require it, but it is absolutely necessary." "Rest?" the boy repeated. "Rest? I want no rest. I have only done my duty, and it will be time enough for me to concern myself about my own rest when I have seen my passengers in a place of safety." "You have acquitted yourself like a man," said Mrs. Weldon, "and you may be assured that my husband, like myself, will never forget the services you have rendered me. I shall urge upon him the request which I am sure he will not refuse, that you shall have your studies completed, so that you may be made a captain for the firm." Tears of gratitude rose to Dick's eyes. He deprecated the praise that was lavished upon him, but rejoiced in the prospect that seemed opening upon his future. Mrs. Weldon assured him that he was dear as a son to her, and pressed a gentle kiss upon his forehead. The lad felt that he was animated, if need be, to yet greater hardships in behalf of his benefactors, and resolved to prove himself even more worthy of their confidence. By the 29th, the wind had so far moderated that Dick thought he might increase the Pilgrim's speed by hoisting the foresail and topsail. "Now, my men, I have some work for you today," he said to the negroes when he came on deck at daybreak. "All right, Captain," answered Hercules. "We are growing rusty for want of something to do." "Why didn't you blow with your big mouth?" said Little Jack. "You could have beaten the wind to all to nothing." Dick laughed and said, "Not a bad idea, Jack. If ever we get becalmed, we must get Hercules to blow into the sails." "I shall be most happy," retorted the giant, and he inflated his huge cheeks till he was the very impersonation of Boreas himself. "But now to work," cried Dick. "We have lost our topsail, and we must contrive to hoist another. Not an easy matter, I can tell you." "I dare say we shall manage it," replied Actaeon. "We must do our best," said Tom. "Can't I help?" inquired Jack. "Of course you can," answered Dick. "Run along to the wheel and assist Bat." Jack strutted off, proud enough of his commission. Under Dick's directions, the negroes commenced their somewhat difficult task. The two topsail, rolled up, had first of all to be hoisted, and then to be made fast to the yard. But so adroitly did the crew carry out the orders that in less than an hour the sail was properly set and flying with a couple of reefs. The foresail and second jib, which had been taken down before the tempest, were hoisted again, and before 10 o'clock the Pilgrim was running along under the three sails which Dick considered were as much as it was prudent to carry. Even at her present speed, the schooner, he reckoned, would be within sight of the American shore in about 10 days.
It was an immense relief to him to find that she was no longer at the mercy of the waves, and when he saw the sails properly set, he returned in good spirits to his post at the helm, not forgetting to thank the temporary helmsman for his services, nor omitting his acknowledgment to Master Jack, who received the compliment with becoming gravity. Although the clouds continued to travel all the next day with great rapidity, they were very much broken, and alternately the Pilgrim was bathed in sunlight and enveloped in vapours, which rolled on towards the east. As the weather cleared, the hatchways were opened in order to ventilate the ship, and the outer air was allowed again to penetrate not only the hold, but the cabin and crew's quarters. The wet sails were hung out to dry, the deck was washed down, for Dick Sands was anxious not to bring his ship into port without having finished her toilet, and he found that his crew could very well spare a few hours daily to get her into proper trim. Notwithstanding the loss of the log, Dick had sufficient experience to be able to make an approximate estimate of the schooner's progress, and after having pointed out to Mrs. Weldon what he imagined was the Pilgrim's true position, he told her that it was his firm impression that land would be sighted in a little more than a week. "And upon what part of South America do you reckon we are likely to find ourselves?" she asked. "That is more than I dare venture to promise," replied Dick, "but I should think somewhere hereabouts." He was pointing the chart to the long shore line of Chile and Peru. They both examined the outspread chart with still closer attention. "Here, you see," resumed Dick, "here is the island we have just left. We left it in the west. The wind has not shifted. We must expect to come in sight of land pretty nearly due east of it. The coast has plenty of harbours. From any one of them you will be able easily to get to San Francisco. You know, I dare say, that the Pacific Navigation Company's steamers touch at all the principal ports. From any of them you will be sure to get direct passage to California." "But do you mean," asked Mrs. Weldon, "that you are not going yourself to take the schooner to San Francisco?" "Not direct," replied the young captain. "I want to see you safe on shore and satisfactorily on your homeward way. When that is done, I shall hope to get competent officers to take the ship to Valparaiso, where she will discharge her cargo, as Captain Hull intended, and afterwards I shall work our way back to San Francisco." "Ah, well, we will see all about that in due time," Mrs. Weldon said, smiling, and after a short pause, added, "At one time, Dick, you seem to have rather a dread of the shore." "Quite true," answered Dick, "but now I am in hopes we may fall in with some passing vessel. We want to have a confirmation as to our true position. I cannot tell you how surprised I am that we have not come across a single vessel, but when we near the land, we shall be able to get a pilot." "But what will happen if we fail to get a pilot?" was Mrs. Weldon's inquiry. She was anxious to learn how far the lad was prepared to meet any emergency. With unhesitating promptness, Dick replied, "Why then, unless the weather takes the control of the ship out of my hands, I must patiently follow the coast until I come to a harbour of refuge. But if the wind should freshen, I should have to adopt other measures." "What then, Dick? What then?" persisted Mrs. Weldon. The boy's brow knitted itself together in resolution, and he said deliberately, "I should run the ship aground." Mrs. Weldon started. "However," Dick continued, "there is no reason to apprehend this. The weather has mended and is likely to mend, and why should we fear about finding a pilot? Let us hope all will be well." Mrs. Weldon at least had satisfied herself on one point. She had ascertained that although Dick did not anticipate disaster, yet he was prepared in the case of emergency to resort to measures from which any but the most experienced seaman would shrink. But although Dick's equanimity had been successful in allaying any misgivings on Mrs. Weldon's part, it must be owned that the condition of the atmosphere caused him very serious uneasiness. The wind remained uncomfortably high, and the barometer gave very ominous indications that it would ere long freshen still more. Dick dreaded that the time was about to return in which once again he must reduce his vessel to a state of bare poles, but so intense was his aversion to having his ship so wrested as it were from his own management that he determined to carry the topsail till it was all but carried away by the force of the blast. Concerned, moreover, for the safety of his masts, the loss of which he acknowledged must be fatal, he had the shrouds well overhauled and the backstays considerably tightened. More than once another contingency occurred to his mind and gave him some anxiety. He could not overlook the possibility of the wind changing all round. What should he do in such a case? He would, of course, endeavour by all means to get the schooner on by incessant tacking, but was there not the certainty of a most hazardous delay? And worse than this, was there not a likelihood of the Pilgrim being once again driven far out to sea? Happily these forebodings were not realised. The wind, after chopping about for several days, at one time blowing from the north and at another from the south, finally settled down into a stiffish gale from the west, which did nothing worse than severely strain the masts. In this weary but hopeful endurance, time passed on. The 5th of April had arrived. It was more than 2 months since the Pilgrim had quitted New Zealand. It was true that during the first weeks of her voyage she had been impeded by protracted calms and contrary winds, but since that time her speed had been rapid.
The very tempest had driven her forwards with unwonted velocity. She had never failed to have her bow towards the land, and yet land seemed as remote as ever. The close line was retreating as they approached it. What could be the solution to the mystery? From the cross-trees, one or other of the negroes was kept incessantly on the watch. Dick Sands himself, telescope in hand, would repeatedly ascend in the hope of holding some lofty peak of the Andes, emerging from the mist that hung over the horizon, but all in vain. False alarms were given more than once. Sometimes Tom, sometimes Hercules, or one of the others would be sure that a distant speck they had descried was assuredly a mountain ridge, but the vapors were continually gathering in such fantastic forms that their unexperienced eyes were soon deceived, and they seldom had to wait long before their fond delusion was all dispelled. At last the expected longing was fulfilled. At 8 o'clock one morning the mist seemed to have broken up with unusual rapidity, and the horizon was singularly clear. Dick had hardly gone aloft when his voice rung out, "Land! Land ahead!" As if summoned by a spell, everyone was on deck in an instant. Mrs. Weldon sanguine of a speedy end to the general anxiety, little Jack, gratified at a new object of curiosity, Cousin Benedict, already scenting a new field for entomological investigation, old Nan and the negroes, eager to set foot upon American soil, all, with the exception of Negoro, all were on deck. But the cook did not stir from his solitude, or betray any sympathy with the general excitement. Whatever hesitation there might be at first soon passed away. One after another soon distinguished the shore they were approaching. And in half an hour there was no room for the most skeptical to doubt that Dick was right. There was land not far ahead. A few miles to the east there was a long, low-lying coast. The chain of the Andes ought to be visible, but it was obscured, of course, by the intervening clouds. The Pilgrim bore down rapidly towards the land, and in a short time its configuration could be plainly made out. Towards the northeast the coast terminated in a headland of moderate height, sheltering a kind of roadstead. On the southeast it stretched out in a long and narrow tongue. The Andes were still waiting to be seen. They must be somewhere in the background, but at present, strange to say, there was only a succession of low cliffs with some trees standing out against the sky. No human habitation, no harbour, not even an indication of a river mouth, could anywhere be seen. The wind remained brisk, and the schooner was driving directly towards the land, with sails shortened as seemed desirable, but Dick realized to himself the fact that he was utterly incapable of altering her course. With eager eyes he scrutinized his situation. Straight ahead was a reef of which the waves were curling, and around which the surf must be tremendous. It could hardly be more than a mile away. The wind seemed brisker than before. After gazing a while, Dick seemed to have come to a sudden resolution. He went quickly aft and took the helm. He had seen a little cove, and had made up his mind that he would try and make his way into it. He did not speak a word. He knew the difficulty of the task he had undertaken. He was aware from the white foam that there was shallow water on either hand, but he kept the secret of the peril to himself, and sought no counsel in coming to his fixed resolve. Dingo had been trotting up and down the deck. All at once he bounded to the fore, and broke out in a piteous howl. It roused Dick from his anxious cogitations. Was it possible that the animal recognized the coast? It almost seemed as if it brought back some painful associations. The howling of the dog had manifestly attracted Negoro's attention. The man emerged from his cabin, and regardless of the dog, stood close to the netting. But although he gazed at the surf, it did not seem to occasion him any alarm. Mrs. Weldon, who was watching him, fancied she saw a flush rise to his face, which involuntarily suggested the thought to her mind that Negoro had seen the place before. Either she had no time or no wish to express what had struck her, or she did not mention it to Dick, who at that moment left the helm and came and stood beside her. Dick looked as if he were taking a lingering farewell of the cove, past which they were being carried beyond his power to help. In a few moments he turned round to Mrs. Weldon and said quietly, "Mrs. Weldon, I am disappointed. I hoped to get the schooner into yonder cove, but there is no chance now. If nothing is done, in half an hour she'll be upon that reef. I have but one alternative left. I must run her aground. It will be utter destruction to the ship, but there is no choice. Your safety is the first and paramount consideration." "Do you mean that there is no other course to be taken, Dick?" "None whatever," said Dick decidedly. "It must be as you will," she said. Forthwith ensued the agitating preparations for stranding. Mrs. Weldon, Jack, Cousin Benedict, and Nan were provided with life belts, while Dick and the negroes made themselves ready for being dashed into the waves. Every precaution that the emergency admitted was duly taken. Mrs. Weldon was entrusted into the special charge of Hercules. Dick made himself responsible for doing all he could for little Jack. Cousin Benedict, who was tolerably calm, was handed over to Bet and Austin, while Actaeon promised to look after Nan. Negoro's nonchalance implied that he was quite capable of shifting for himself. Dick had the forethought also to order about a dozen barrels of their cargo to be brought in front, so that when the Pilgrim struck, the oil escaping and flitting on the waves would temporarily lull their fury and make smooth the water for the passage of the ship. After satisfying himself that there was no other measure to be taken to ameliorate the peril, Dick Sands returned to the helm. The schooner was all but put upon the reef, and only a few cables' lengths from the shore. Her starboard quarter, indeed, was already bathed in the seething foam, and any instant the keel might be expected to grate upon the underlying rock. Presently a change of colour in the water was observed. It revealed a passage between the rocks. Dick gave the wheel a turn. He saw the chance of getting aground nearer to the shore than he dared to hope, and he made the most of it. He steered the schooner right into the narrow channel. The sea was furious, and dashed vehemently upon the crags on either hand. "Now, my lads," he cried to his crew, "now's your time. Out with your oil. Let it run." Ready for the order, the negroes poured out the oil, and the raging waters were stilled as if by magic. A few moments more, and perchance they would rage more vehemently than ever. But for the instant they were lulled. The Pilgrim, meanwhile, had glided onwards, and made dead for the adjacent shore. There was a sudden shock. Caught by an enormous wave, the schooner had been hurled aground. Her masts had fallen, fortunately without injury to anyone on board. But the vessel had parted amidships, and was foundering. The water was rushing irresistibly into the hold. The shore, however, was not half a cable's length away. There was a low, dark ridge of rocks that was united to the beach. It afforded ample means of rescue, and in less than 10 minutes the Pilgrim's captain, crew, and passengers were all landed, with their lives, at the foot of the overhanging cliff. End of Part the First, Chapter 13. Recording by Alex C. Talander, Davis, California. www.alexctalander.com